This is Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. All talk and all crime, the nation's biggest murders, financial crimes on Wall Street, the facts, the forensics, the inside stories today. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health Emerita at NYU and Visiting Professor of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell. She has a Ph.D. in Molecular Biology and a Master's in Public Health and Nutrition from Cal Berkeley. Her new book, just out, Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. Welcome, Professor. Good to have you on board. And an industry rife with conflict of interest. Isn't your name a conflict of interest? But we know it's Nessel, not Nestle. Let me ask you, first off, you mustn't be too popular in the industry kind of as a food cop. Is that true? And do you have kind of a contrarian personality? Or tell us.
No, I couldn't be sweeter. and in fact, I have lovely relationships with the heads and executives of many food companies who are very interested to hear what I have to say. And off the record, usually agree with me.
Let me start with Nestle, the company. You cite them as ethics and legal violations, and particularly related to breast milk substitutes. What's that about?
Well, that's an old story.
Yes.
And one that some people believe continues into the future. But in the 1980s, the Nestle company was doing extremely aggressive marketing of infant formulas, particularly in developing countries where the water supply was contaminated. And mothers would take the powdered milk and dilute it in contaminated water, and the use of infant formulas was responsible for the deaths of a large number of children. It was quite a scandal. And the marketing was pretty aggressive. They had people dressed up as doctors and nurses who were going there. And there was a worldwide outcry about it. And every country in the world, except for the United States and South Africa, signed an agreement about marketing, responsible marketing of breast milk substitutes, particularly in developing countries, because breastfeeding solves that problem. You don't have to worry about contaminated water. Eventually the United States signed it, but there's still a huge fuss about it. Infant formula companies want to sell infant formulas. Everybody else thinks that moms would be better off breastfeeding if they can.
All right. We'll talk about this in more detail as we go on, but you talk about an industry that's kind of rife with conflict of interest. You wear the white hat. How do you avoid conflict of interest?
Well, I actually work very hard at it. It's not easy because as a professional nutritionist, I need to know what food companies are doing, and I need to have relationships with them, and they are very, very generous about relationships with nutrition professionals. They sponsor meetings. They send information. They provide books. They provide pamphlets. They give gifts. They pay for meals. They invite me to speak all over the place. And over the years, I've developed a policy for dealing with that to try to avoid being influenced. Much of the influence of this kind of giving is unconscious. People aren't even aware that they're being influenced. So I think you have to work very hard to be aware of it, and I try. So I will take, because I'm an academic and I don't have a huge salary, I will accept travel reimbursement, hotel reimbursement, and meal reimbursement, and I do pick up swag at meetings, you know, little things that they give away. What I don't do is personally take honoraria. So I'm often offered quite a bit of money to speak, and if it's a food company, I ask them to donate the money to one of two things at NYU, but I don't take it personally.
Is there a single biggest nutrition misconception that we have, the general public?
Oh, I think the general one is that what you eat is more important than how much you eat for obesity. What you eat is very important for health. For obesity, I'm afraid calories count.
On obesity, I've always read, and maybe I'm wrong, that we're one of the worst in the developed nations. Who bears responsibility for that? The individuals?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I have a book called Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. It came out in 2002, and in that book I talk about how food industry marketing affects people's food choices. We all think that we are totally independent in the choices we make of food, but food companies spend a fortune to try to get us to buy their products instead of somebody else's, or to eat more in general. And that, yeah, I have some sympathy for them, because we have a food environment in the United States that has about 4,000 calories a day available for every man, woman, and little tiny baby in the country, and that's roughly twice what the country needs. So this is a hugely competitive industry. And food companies have to sell in that industry. They're not social service agencies. They're not public health agencies. They're businesses that have stockholders to please. And so to do that, they market, and they do that in ways that most people don't even notice. I certainly didn't for a very long time. And then they do things like fund research that makes their products seem healthier than other people's products. And that's what this last book is about.
While we're on the business aspect of it and the economics, I see that the most profitable products end up the highest calorie, lowest nutritional value, what you might call junk foods and beverages, and that obviously Wall Street puts huge quarterly pressures on, which has also caused a lot of these firms to shut their in-house basic research down. So the economic pressure is not good.
Oh, it's fierce, and it's fierce because of the food system has so many calories in it, but also because of the Wall Street pressures. And those changed in the early 1980s from valuing blue-chip stocks that gave long, slow returns on investment to the kind of investment environment we have now, where companies are expected to produce immediate higher returns on investment and produce growth every 90 days. It's terrible for all companies, but I think for food companies, it's particularly bad.
Is there, in your mind, a worst company or industry segment on the skewing of science?
Oh, no, they all do it. all of them. I mean, some of them do it more than others, but I started running across, I mean, I've been writing about food industry funding of research since the early 2000s, and used an article that I'd written as part of a chapter in my book, Food Politics, and then I kind of forgot about it until I was working on Soda Politics, a book that came out in 2015, where I was looking at Coca-Cola's funding of research and could see that Coca-Cola was funding research studies for three purposes. One was to show that sugar-sweetened beverages have no effect on obesity or diabetes. A second was to say that was to demonstrate that any research that showed a connection between sugary drinks and obesity and diabetes were so badly done that you didn't have to pay any attention to them. And then the third was to demonstrate that physical activity was more important than what you ate or drank in your body weight. And the studies that were funded by Coca-Cola came out one after another, giving these kinds of results, when studies funded by other sources were demonstrating just the opposite. So I started paying attention to that, and while the book was in press, I was running across studies that were funded by food companies so often that every time I had five of them, I would post them on my website. And I did that for a year. And at the end of a year, I had 168 studies that were funded by food companies.
Uh-huh.
And of those, 156 had results that were favorable to the sponsor's interest. What a coincidence!
Jeez.
Now, this was not a scientific study because it was sort of casually collected, but I think it produced a lot of information. One was that it's easier to find industry-funded studies that come out with results favorable. In fact, I can tell from the title of a study whether some food company sponsored it. Some of them are just so obvious. Nobody else would do research like that. I mean, my current favorite is, I have several current favorites, but one of them is that mangoes are better than fiber supplements for relieving symptoms of constipation. I love mangoes. You know, I love fruit in general. Any fruit would do that. And I looked at the title of that study and said, who could possibly have funded that? Bingo, the National Mango Board, big surprise. And so at the end of my collection of this 168 studies, I looked at all the different companies that were funding these things, and these were companies that made healthy foods. They were companies that made unhealthy foods. Everybody's trying to get a market edge.
The inside story of how food companies bend the truth on what's in what we eat. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health Emerita at NYU. Welcome, Professor. Good to have you on board. Is what Coca-Cola was doing then, and I think you say in the book they've improved a bit, is that any different than what tobacco was doing?
Oh, in fact, Coca-Cola was following what is known as the tobacco industry playbook, which was a set of strategies that cigarette company executives used in order to counter information that their products cause cancer. And these strategies were very well defined. They were laid out in all kinds of documents that have been found. And the first thing you do is you cast doubt on the research. So if there's a study that shows that links cigarettes to lung cancer, the first thing you do is criticize the way the study was being done. You criticize the people who did the study as being biased. And then there are lots of other things that they did. But research was certainly the number one strategy. Cast doubt.
Do you have you ever been pressured by Coke?
No, actually, I've met with the CEO of Coca-Cola North America 3 times. No.
You talk about, in your non-scientific study, 156 out of 168 sponsored research linked directly to the company and therefore favorable. Can sales and sales growth focus coexist with science in sponsoring research?
I think it can, but not the way it's done now. I think there's a huge ethical problem involved in this, and we see this in the newspapers all the time these days. The most recent example is the business of the alcohol industry's funding of an enormous research study at the National Institutes of Health, where it turned out that the study was, there was collusion between the investigators and people at the NIH to absolutely guarantee the alcohol industry that drinking one day a day, a study of drinking one drink a day, would show that alcohol reduced the risk of heart disease and would not show harm. They would not run the study long enough to show any harm from
alcohol. Oh, boy, you know, that's a big thing. I've read that, and I think as a consumer, you want to buy that. You know, I mean, buy it, you know, as an excuse to be able to drink.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, the alcohol industry for decades has tried to demonstrate that wine is a health food. It's got antioxidants. Mm-hmm. Never mind the harm that is caused by excessive drinking of alcohol. So this was a particularly shocking example because it involved the primary agency that funds independent research in the United States, and the idea that that agency is funding research that is not independent is absolutely shocking. It even shocked me, and I thought I couldn't be shocked by any of this anymore.
Do you think, therefore, that there is not scientific evidence that one drink a day is heart healthy and maybe even, you know, heart beneficial?
Well, I don't really know. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of studies years ago that demonstrated that people who drank one drink a day, not more than that, mm-hmm. but one drink a day, mm-hmm. Had a lower risk of heart disease. But those results have been called into question lately, and there have been other studies that have been giving different results. So we really do need an independent study to examine that question. It's an important question.
Yeah, it is.
But there's a big difference between designing a study to demonstrate a benefit of a product and designing a study to show what the effect is. And there's evidence that this study was being designed to show a benefit.
Let me ask you, I mean, Coke is sugar and water, which is, you know, nothing basically that's good for you. Is aspartame NutraSweet, has that been shown to be safe?
Well, the FDA says they are. And whether they're, you know, and there's lots and lots of people consume them, and whether there are problems as a result has been very, very difficult to demonstrate. I think there are lots of questions about artificial sweeteners. I don't like the way they taste.
Mm-hmm.
And they go under my category of artificial, and I have a food rule, never consume anything artificial. I'd much rather consume sugar, if the truth be known, because at least we know how to metabolize it. I think it's also a question that requires independent science to look at, and we could use some of that.
Let's do the last couple of minutes in this segment on you talk about ways companies manipulate research. You've already talked about some, but let me go through them. One, you say front groups. What are those?
Well, front groups are groups that are paid for by industry but appear to be independent. And the use of front groups has been perfected by the drug industry, the pharmaceutical drug industry, to argue for brand name drugs. I give an example in the book of a group organized to argue for a drug demonstrably ineffective, but claimed to promote women's sexual desire. And that's an interesting story because it was so obvious. But there are food industry front groups, too. And these are groups to be independent that claim to be independent think tanks. And in fact are sponsored by industry, or in the case of advocacy for soda taxes, the soda industry has paid for front groups to argue to not tax sodas. So you always have to be careful when you're looking at these groups that are arguing one way or the other. Who funds them? Who funds them is always an interesting question to ask.
I think the number is right. 89% or 90% of doctors are getting gifts from drug companies, et cetera, or consulting deals. And is that obviously as bad as it would look on the surface?
Oh, I think it's terrible. And it's been the source of agony in the medical profession for decades. I think the earliest studies that I've been able to find of the effects of drug industry funding on physician prescription behavior go back to the 1960s at least, and there are thousands of studies and libraries full of books complaining about drug industry influence on the medical profession. It got so bad that when the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, it included a provision that pharmaceutical companies had to disclose who they gave money to and how much they gave, and that money that disclosures had to be publicly available on a website, and you can just go onto that website and put in the name of your favorite doctor and find out who that doctor receives drug industry money from, and then you can look at that doctor's prescription practices and see if that doctor is prescribing the particular brand name drugs of the company that's paying the doctor. And so it's been possible to do these kinds of studies for pharmaceutical funding that's not possible to do for food industry funding.
All right, just under a minute, so you got to be quick. I went to Tufts, and when I was my senior year, John Mayer was brought in, a great nutritionist. Tufts become a leader in nutrition. Is Tufts a really good, unbiased academic source? And we'll talk about universities later.
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking to. Tufts has a terrific nutrition program to this day, a really excellent one, with very good instructors and very good students. But what individuals are doing needs to be looked at.
We'll look at Food Enemy number 1 coming up. From Philly to Fresno, Brooklyn to Boston, Data Cable Superstars has the best prices on installation of Cat 5 and Cat 6 wiring for cameras, computers, phone, and data, specializing in off-peak installs as to not interrupt your workflow. If this is an I need it done yesterday situation, then it's time to call Data Cable Superstars at 203-942-1427 or go to datacablesuperstars.com. That's datacablesuperstars, all one word, .com. Data Cable Superstars, where estimates and big ideas are always free. And we're back with Professor Marian Nestle. She's written Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. It's just out. And is sugar food enemy number one?
Oh, I think calories are a much bigger problem. But whenever you look at sugar as opposed to everything else in the diet, it's really hard to tease out what's sugar and what's everything else. But everybody would be healthier eating less sugar. It's calories and nothing else.
Is sugar in fruit?
Oh, yes.
Is that bad? Is that good sugar, though, I'm always told, whatever that is?
Well, it's the same sugar. It's just that it's accompanied by vitamins, minerals, fiber, and other kinds of good things. When you drink your sugar as a sugary beverage, it's accompanied by nothing, and so you get calories and no other nutritional value. We used to call them empty calories. I like that term.
What is the difference in science and good and bad between high fructose corn syrup versus sucrose, which is sugar?
Well, they're both sugar, or sugars, plural. Mm-hmm. Sucrose is glucose and fructose stuck together, but easily taken apart. And high fructose corn syrup is glucose and fructose separated. In the body, they're basically the same.
How do candy manufacturers and food companies justify the added sugar thing?
Well, candy is sugar. We love the taste of sugar. I love the taste of sugar. Babies love, you know, we're born with loving the taste of sugar because it encourages babies to suck on their mother's breast and get. Milk has lactose in it. It's a sugar and it's sweet. And you want to encourage babies to want to feed, and that's one of the ways we do it. And we carry that taste through life, and there's sugar in everything. Everybody likes the taste of sugar.
The candy industry, say, is a $35 billion industry, and there's some great claims coming out of their research. Eating candy has no effect on weight or health. Children who eat candy tend to be less overweight and obese, and chocolate is healthy to the heart. Talk about that.
Well, my first question is, who paid for those studies? Bingo, the National Confectioners Association. you can design a study to show that kids who eat candy have less overweight and healthier diets. I mean, it depends on what kinds of questions you ask and how you design the study. And, of course, they want to do studies that show those kinds of things, and they hire or recruit researchers who are perfectly happy to do studies like that.
Now, you talked about in-house sort of more basic research in companies being sort of cut because of this Wall Street pressure. When they did that, were the studies more honest?
Well, the studies were different. These kinds of studies that have these skewed research results and seem to be for marketing purposes are for marketing purposes. They're marketing studies. They're not basic research studies. So when the big food companies had research enterprises, they were doing both kinds of studies. They were doing studies aimed at product development and looking at the qualities of the products, but they also were doing studies to see what the effects of those products were. When the research shifted out of the companies, they were no longer doing any kind of basic research at all. They outsourced their basic research, and they outsourced their marketing studies as well. But the line between them blurred.
You look to meats now. Is being a vegan healthier than meat eating? First off,
It depends on what else you eat. Vegan diets, if they're done well, can be quite healthy.
And they've produced studies that show red meat yields no effect on cholesterol.
The meat industry does that.
Yes.
Oh, yes. And there's a video by a man named Michael Greger floating around on the internet that shows exactly how they do it. There's a really big difference between designing a study to show an effect of a product and designing a study to show its benefit. I get letters all the time from the meat industry. I got one yesterday from the meat industry saying we're looking for studies to show essentially the benefits of meat, the healthful qualities of meat. We want studies that are going to demonstrate that. They're not looking for long-term clinical trials to see what the difference is between diets that are high in meat and diets that are low in meat. Those are too risky. And they might risk showing harm. They certainly are unlikely to show benefit. Nobody wants to fund trials like that. They're really expensive.
Universities, you talk about, they're desperate for grants. They need grants. I assume a lot of these studies you're talking about do come from university professors, right?
Oh, yes, they do. And most university research is still funded by independent sources, even though the National Institutes of Health has kind of capped the amount of money that it's putting into this. And the sources, the number of investigators is increasing. The funding is kind of leveling off. And industry has moved into the gap and is funding an increasing percentage mm-hmm. of research. But in the food area, it's still a small percentage. I've only seen one study about it, and it's an unpublished study, and it looks to me like it's about 15% to 20% of nutrition research is funded by the food industry, but that's a soft number. I'm not sure that's accurate.
Do the universities have any sort of structure that guarantees they don't compromise their integrity on these kinds and, just sell their integrity essentially?
Well, I think a guarantee is too strong a word. Any university that takes funding from the federal government has an elaborate system of checking for conflicts of interest. I get a form every year from my university asking me to list potential industry support that might create conflicts of interest, and then presumably somebody looks at those and fusses about them. But the alcohol study that I mentioned earlier went through universities, and somehow all of that got through without anybody noticing. It got through NIH without anybody noticing. So the system isn't perfect. And I have to say that the whole business of disclosure of industry funding is extremely uncomfortable. I find it uncomfortable. I don't like to talk about the companies that I give lectures for and the amount of money that they give me, even though I turn the money over to the university. Mm-hmm. It's still not, we don't like to talk about money in our society. At least in a personal way. It makes people really uncomfortable. And there also doesn't seem, at least in the nutrition profession, I don't see a strong culture of ethics around taking food industry funding. Many of my colleagues think it's perfectly okay to do that. They don't see anything wrong with it. They don't believe that it affects the design, conduct, or outcome of their research. They don't see it. And there's a whole research literature on that, too.
And the egg industry, they've tried to sponsor research that shows there's no hard impact. And here, I guess, I found some impurity with Tufts. So they were big in soliciting egg industry research dollars.
It's hard to know how all of this happens. The egg story is an interesting one because you have to have some sympathy for the egg industry. Once the cholesterol story came out, that a high blood cholesterol increases the risk for heart disease, then you start looking at the effects of dietary cholesterol on blood cholesterol, and it seemed obvious that high diets, high in dietary cholesterol, and that means eggs because they're the biggest source of cholesterol in American diets. The idea that eggs would raise blood cholesterol levels came into public consciousness, and egg sales declined dramatically. So the egg industry is fighting back, and it fought back by funding studies, and those studies, surprise, showed that there was no effect on eggs. Eating eggs didn't raise blood cholesterol levels, whereas other studies have shown that. At this point, it's so hard to untangle the business about eggs and cholesterol, in part because so many people are taking statins, that this is something that is so confusing, and you have no idea what's going on. The dietary guidelines for Americans that came out in 2015 sort of changed the recommendation and said, you don't have to worry about dietary cholesterol. Dietary cholesterol only has a small effect in raising blood cholesterol levels. Saturated fat has a much greater effect. They said, okay, you don't need to worry about dietary cholesterol, but you should eat as few eggs as possible. How are you supposed to make sense of that? So I don't think we really know where we are on that one. And that's an example of an industry that came in and funded research in its own interest and has now completely confused the issue. I don't know whether we'll ever get it straightened out.
Well, we're talking about this very clinically, but a lot of this is pretty scandalous. Final segment, we'll see if there's a way to fix nutritional misinformation.
Would you like to host your own radio program or podcast? Park City Productions 06604 is a Bridgeport, Connecticut-based radio broadcast solutions company. Follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's Park City Productions 06604. Call us at 203-522-8801.
We're back with Marion Nessel for our final segment, leading academic nutritionist, a whistleblower, too. Are there some fundamental reforms that right at the top can help with these misleading science claims? Should industry and companies even be allowed to sponsor research?
Well, I think they can sponsor research, but they need to do it in a way that the influence is blocked in some way. I mean, I think it would be perfectly reasonable for companies to donate money to a common fund that is administered by some independent third party. But there are examples of that happening in the past. And even there, the biases were there because the supposedly independent groups that were administering the funds had to keep getting the funds coming in and therefore had to please the donors. So you have to take the pleasing of donors out of the equation somehow. And the only way that I can think of doing that is by taxing companies and requiring them to donate to a research fund that would then be administered in some way. But of course, companies, they won't do it voluntarily, because if they are voluntarily taking themselves out of the picture, they're not going to get the results they want. And the whole point of funding this research is to get the results that they want.
Do you think that if a study does not go the way they want, they actually cover it up?
Well, that has been shown over and over and over again in drug industry-funded research. There's much less information about food industry-funded research, and I wasn't able to find any examples of that kind of behavior. Whether they exist or not is an open question. But particularly for the companies that are working with research groups that have as their business doing these kinds of studies for food companies. I'm not talking about academic researchers, but there are companies that do research for, like the confectionery study we talked about earlier. I don't know whether ones with negative results are suppressed. I don't have any evidence for it. What we do see is that is a great deal of interaction between the funder and the investigator, even if the investigator says in the disclosure statement in the published paper that the funder had no influence. There are plenty of examples, particularly through emails collected from Coca-Cola and researchers that came out through various investigations, that Coca-Cola was very actively engaged in influencing the research that these investigators were doing through very close personal contacts and, you know, sort of discussions about how these things would work. They also tried to influence reporters who were writing about the research. And we would never know about that if those emails hadn't come to light.
The USDA has obviously huge credibility, recommended diet that they publish. Is that unbiased? Is that legitimate?
Many of the biases came in because the government just couldn't fight the meat industry on recommendations to eat less meat, that kind of thing. And so dietary guidelines are not very straightforward. It's no wonder the public is confused about nutrition.
The examples now of where they get to put a label on which looks official, like you talk about Fruit Loops had smart choices on it, yet 44% of the calories are sugar.
Well, that was a historical example of an industry-funded effort to try to put a front-of-package label on products that would label them as healthy. And, I mean, it was really a scandal at the time. And the first product to get one of these stamps of healthy approval was Fruit Loops, where 44% of the calories came from sugar. That program disappeared.
Isn't there any regulatory control over using terms like smart choices? Or does natural always mean natural?
Well, the FDA doesn't have a definition of natural, and the current head of the FDA says that the agency is working on one.
Someone like yourself, if you're doing something that's going to come out with a negative result, do they try and threaten you? Do they just try and get research against you? Or,
well, I've only been threatened once, really, and that was when my book Food Politics came out in 2002. I was on a radio program and I blithely said something like, you should reduce your intake of sugary drinks because they contain sugar and water and nothing else.
Oh boy, that's a radical.
And the Sugar Association threatened a lawsuit.
Really?
Because they said, I should have known that soft drinks do not contain sugar. They contain high fructose corn syrup. I thought that was hilariously funny until somebody said they were
going to sue you.
They were going to sue me over that. And I think the high fructose corn syrup and table sugar are basically the same. Just the high fructose corn syrup is cheaper. And the I had to talk to a lawyer and write a letter back and go through all this stuff. I have those letters posted on my website. I think they're really quite funny.
In fact, we will end on that note. Tell folks what your blog site is.
It's foodpolitics.com, and I write a daily blog during the week, and I also post my papers and letters and all the things that come in. It has a lot of information on it.
Well, the book has an appropriate title, after all. It's Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. Great thanks to Professor Marion Nestle from NYU and Cornell's. And finally, Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell got the only exclusive interview with Bruno Exil, better known worldwide as the London Whale, while $6 billion were trading for J.P. Morgan. Was he a rogue, out-of-control trader, or was he a fall guy for senior management at J.P. Morgan? Joining us from London is Bradley Hope, reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covering finance and malfeasance, of which there's apparently a fair amount of. Spent 6 years as a correspondent in the Middle East, where he covered the Arab Spring uprisings. He was detained by authorities in Bahrain, reporter from the front lines of the Libyan civil war, tear gassed in the Egyptian Arab Spring uprising, and he's the author of The Last Days of the Pharaoh on the Final Days of Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak. His co-author, Tom Wright, is a Hong Kong-based correspondent for the journal. He was one of the first journalists to arrive at the scene of the raid in which the Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden. And together, their new book is The Billion Dollar Whale, The Man Who Fooled Wall Street, Hollywood, and the World. Welcome from London, Bradley.
Thank you very much. So The Billion Dollar Whale refers to this young Malaysian financier called Joe Lo. He just turned 37 years old the other day. And at the time, his peak, you know, during the period that our book's about, he was in his late 20s and early 30s. And he was this kind of no-name figure, who is now a big-name figure, that was behind what U.S. and other investigators believe is one of the greatest frauds that ever was pulled off, where they basically siphoned away upwards of $6 billion from this sovereign wealth fund. And all of the money that was stolen was actually borrowed money, money that Goldman Sachs helped Malaysia borrow. And it's having these endless ramifications, including, you know, the Malaysian government has changed, and there's been all kinds of impacts.
We're going to go through those. The breaking news is that Goldman Sachs had let go of the managing director, the partner that was in charge of this relationship and brought in all these fees, Tim Leissner, and kind of positioned him as a rogue guy. Well, Leissner's testimony has now come out, and maybe you can take us through it. It does sort of implicate Goldman.
Yeah, well, for a long time, we didn't really know what was the full picture of Tim Leissner. Among the people that had been involved in this whole scandal, he's been a little bit of a darker character for us. Darker in the sense we didn't really know his full story. And what happened was he was put on leave when the 1MDB scandal kind of blew up. And they found that he had written this letter that was unauthorized, and it gave them a reason to sort of essentially fire the guy. And at the time, it didn't seem like that big of a scandal for him. You know, he wrote a letter he wasn't supposed to write, and it wasn't even clear he ever sent the letter. But over time, things have started to emerge that gave us a clearer picture. And last week was the ultimate moment in that kind of clearing picture, because he pleaded guilty to basically being a key participant in this fraud and from the very beginning. So from the beginning of this Malaysian fund, he was getting money in an offshore account, paying it in bribes to other officials, and he pled guilty. And so it's really just, and it was an incredible moment. And the ramifications keep coming for Goldman, because in some of the court documents from the Department of Justice, he mentions other people at Goldman knew that this was going on. One of his underlings is also under arrest in this case. But then another guy was put on leave because he was essentially, without naming him, mentioned in Leissner's plea, saying that this guy knew about it as well. And then the latest news that came out was that Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman, met this Joe Lo character on at least two occasions. And there's all kinds of stuff. It just keeps coming. You know, there's a lot of detail about what was going on in Goldman, how this was approved, and it's becoming a big Goldman story.
Yeah, we've seen in the past that if you indict criminally a bank, it often means it's over with.
In any of these cases, like I think of like the Steve Cohen kind of insider trading investigation.
Yeah.
There's obviously the best evidence is about one guy doing a particular thing, and the hardest evidence is to prove that people higher up have any knowledge of anything. So I think maybe they always assumed that. I mean, and they would have full access to the inside emails of Goldman, so they would know there was no apparent information that showed that there was like this widespread conspiracy within the bank. But I think that's actually not the test, because there is just so many opportunities that Goldman had to detect that this guy Joe Lo was heavily involved in all these deals. And yes, Leissner lied to people and told them he wasn't involved. But if anybody was doing like just an ounce of proper due diligence on these deals, they would have known something was up. Even one of my favorite ones, 1MDB. And so basically, 1MDB was controlled by Joe Lo from behind the scenes. even though he didn't have a role there, everyone kind of reported to him. Mm-hmm. And because he had this relationship with the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and this fund was his, was the Prime Minister's fund, 1MDB told Goldman, look, when we raise this money, the billions of dollars, we want you to transfer it to our account in this tiny Swiss bank in Switzerland. And even Goldman's lawyer said, are you guys sure? This sounds a bit funny. And they're like, no, it's fine. It's fine. So there's just a lot of that kind of stuff that, that happened at Goldman.
And we should say, we'll talk about Goldman later too, but this whole thing appeared to me to be really rooted in the failure of monitoring the global flow of funds. And you have money laundering, offshore banks not following laws, corruptions, law firms involved. You use a figure, $32 trillion of money laundering, which is bigger than the U.S. and China's GDPs. Is this rooted really in the failure of the system to figure out how to control these flow of funds?
The global financial system is kind of assumes that deals between countries, between sovereign wealth fund A and sovereign wealth fund B, are going to be big ticket numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there are 700 million going this way and a billion going that way, and they're saying, no, don't worry, this is Malaysia, the government of Malaysia's money, this is their sovereign wealth fund. There was kind of this assumption that that's how things work. Because, you can imagine being the guy who's seeing these flows. It would be pretty hard to imagine that someone just stole $700 million in the course of like 10 minutes. So that's one level. But then the higher level, I think this year it's becoming ever more clear, is that, for a long time, especially the Western kind of leadership countries when it comes to the global financial system have allowed this offshore opaque system to get larger and larger and larger. And it depends on all these different pieces, offshore secrecy companies, banks that don't do proper compliance. But, it's an incredibly large system, and it's so big now that to turn it back, it's almost going to be a monumental task, because all that money will fight the effort to turn things back. I'm not sure if you followed this case in Europe called Danske Bank, this Danish bank. They had this tiny Estonian branch, mm-hmm. that over the course of 9 years saw $200 billion flow through it.
Jeez.
That they now think is probably all suspicious. So, and most of it from Russia. So this like tiny branch was doing that. You can imagine what else is going on out there.
We want to thank all of our loyal listeners again for listening to Best of Forensic Talk 2018, and every Monday night listening to Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Of course, our sister show syndicated nationally, Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Happy New Year, everybody.